England Before the Reformation. Chapter 10. Learning at Florence. This Reformation was to be the result of two distinct forces, the revival of learning and the resurrection of the Word of God. The latter was the principal cause, but the former was necessary as a means. Without it, the living waters of the gospel would probably have traversed the age, like summer streams which soon dry up, such as those which had burst forth here and there during the Middle Ages. It would not have become that majestic river, which, by its inundations, fertilized all the earth. It was necessary to discover and examine the original fountains, and for this end the study of Greek and Hebrew was indispensable. Lollardism and Humanism, the study of the classics, were the two laboratories of the Reform. We have seen the preparations of the one, we must now trace the commencement of the other, and as we have discovered the light in the lowly valleys, we shall discern it also on the lofty mountain tops. About the end of the 15th century, several young Englishmen chanced to be at Florence, attracted thither by the literary glory which environed the city of the Medici. Cosmo had collected together a great number of works of antiquity, and his palace was thronged with learned men. William Selling, a young English ecclesiastic, afterwards distinguished at Canterbury by his zeal in collecting valuable manuscripts, his fellow countrymen, Grocyn, Lilly, and Latimer, more bashful than a maiden, and above all, Lineker, whom Erasmus ranked before all the scholars of Italy, used to meet in the delicious villa of the Medici with Politian, Calcondiles, and other men of learning, and there, in the calm evenings of summer, under that glorious Tuscan sky, they dreamed romantic visions of the Platonic philosophy. When they returned to England, these learned men laid before the youth of Oxford the marvelous treasures of the Greek language. Some Italians even, attracted by the desire to enlighten the barbarians, and a little, it may be, by the brilliant offers made them, quitted their beloved country for the distant Britain. Cornelius Vitelli taught at Oxford, and Caius Amberino at Cambridge. Caxton imported the art of printing from Germany, and the nation hailed with enthusiasm the brilliant dawn which was breaking at last in their cloudy sky. While learning was reviving in England, a new dynasty succeeded to the throne, bringing with it that energy of character which of itself is able to effect great revolutions. The Tudors succeeded the Plantagenets. That inflexible intrepidity by which the reformers of Germany, Switzerland, France, and Scotland were distinguished, did not exist so generally in those of England, but it was found in the character of her kings, who often stretched it even to violence. It may be that to this preponderance of energy in its rulers, the Church owes the preponderance of the state in its affairs. Henry Tudor, the Louis XI of England, was a clever prince, of decided but suspicious character, avaricious and narrow-minded. Being descended from a Welsh family, he belonged to that ancient race of Celts who had so long contended against the papacy. Henry had extinguished faction at home, and taught foreign nations to respect his power. A good genius seemed to exercise a salutary influence over his court, as well as over himself. This was his mother, the Countess of Richmond. From her closet, where she consecrated the first 5 hours of the day to reading, meditation, and prayer, she moved to another part of the palace to dress the wounds of some of the lowest mendicants. Thence she passed into the gay saloons, where she would converse with the scholars, whom she encouraged by her munificence. This noble lady's passion for study, of which her son inherited but little, was not without its influence in her family. Arthur and Henry, the king's eldest sons, trembled in their father's presence, but, captivated by the affection of their pious grandmother, they began to find a pleasure in the society of learned men. An important circumstance gave a new impulse to one of them. Among the countess's friends was Monch, who had known Erasmus at Paris, and heard his cutting sarcasms upon the schoolmen and friars. He invited the illustrious Dutchman to England, and Erasmus, who was fearful of catching the plague, gladly accepted the invitation, and set out for what he believed to be the kingdom of darkness. But he had not been long in England before he discovered unexpected light. Shortly after his arrival, happening to dine with the Lord Mayor, Erasmus noticed on the other side of the table a young man of 19, slender, fresh-colored, with blue eyes, coarse hands, and the right shoulder somewhat higher than the other. His features indicated affability and gaiety, and pleasant jests were continually dropping from his lips. If he could not find a joke in English, he would in French, and even in Latin or Greek. A literary contest soon ensued between Erasmus and the English youth. The former, astonished at meeting with anyone that could hold his own against him, exclaimed, "Aut tuis moris aut nullis. You are either more or nobody." And his companion, who had not learnt the stranger's name, quickly replied, "Aut tuis Erasmus aut diabolus. You are either the devil or Erasmus." More flung himself into the arms of Erasmus, and they became inseparable friends. More was continually joking, even with women, teasing the young maidens, and making fun of the dull, though without any tinge of ill nature in his jests. But under this sportive exterior he concealed a deep understanding. He was at that time lecturing on Augustine's City of God before a numerous audience composed of priests and aged men. The thought of eternity had seized him, and being ignorant of that internal discipline of the Holy Ghost, which is the only true discipline, he had recourse to the scourge on every Friday. Thomas More is the ideal of the Catholicism of this period. He had, like the Romish system, two poles, worldliness and asceticism, which, although contrary, often meet together. In fact, asceticism makes a sacrifice of self, only to preserve it, just as a traveler attacked by robbers will readily give up a portion of his treasures to save the rest. This was the case with More, if we rightly understand his character. He sacrificed the accessories of his fallen nature to save that same nature. He submitted to fasts and vigils, wore a shirt of haircloth, mortified his body by small chains next to his skin. In a word, he immolated everything in order to preserve that self which a real regeneration alone can sacrifice. From London, Erasmus went to Oxford, where he met with John Colet, a friend of More's, but older, and a very dissimilar character. Colet, the scion of an ancient family, was a very portly man, of imposing aspect, great fortune, and elegance of manners, to which Erasmus had not been accustomed. Order, cleanliness, and decorum prevailed in his person and in his house. He kept an excellent table, which was open to all the friends of learning, and at which the Dutchman, no great admirer of the colleges of Paris with their sour wine and stale eggs, was glad to take a seat. He there met also most of the classical scholars of England, especially Grocyn, Lineker, Thomas Wolsey, Bursar of Magdalene College, Halsey, and some others. "I cannot tell you how I am delighted with your England," he wrote to Lord Mountjoy from Oxford. "With such men I could willingly live in the farthest coasts of Scythia. But if Erasmus on the banks of the Thames found a Maecenas in Lord Mountjoy, a Labeo and perhaps a Virgil in More, he nowhere found an Augustus." One day, as he was expressing his regrets and his fears to More, the latter said, "Come, let us go to Eltham. Perhaps we shall find there what you are looking for." They set out, More jesting all the way, inwardly resolving to expiate his gaiety by a severe scourging at night. On their arrival they were heartily welcomed by Lord and Lady Munch, the governor and governess of the king's children. As the two friends entered the hall, a pleasing and unexpected sight greeted Erasmus. The whole of the family were assembled, and they found themselves surrounded not only by some of the royal household, but by the domestics of Lord Mountjoy also. On the right stood the Princess Margaret, a girl of 11 years, whose great-grandson under the name of Stuart was to continue the tutor in England. On the left was Mary, a child 4 years of age. Edmund was in his nurse's arms. And in the middle of the circle, between his two sisters, stood a boy, at that time only 9 years old, whose handsome features, royal carriage, intelligent eye, and exquisite courtesy had an extraordinary charm for Erasmus. That boy was Henry, Duke of York, the king's second son, born on the June 28, 1491. More, advancing towards the young prince, presented to him some piece of his own writing, and from that hour Erasmus kept up a friendly intercourse with Henry, which in all probability exercised a certain influence over the destinies of England. The scholar of Rotterdam was delighted to see the prince excel in all the manly sports of the day. He sat his horse with perfect grace and rare intrepidity, could hurl a javelin farther than any of his companions, and having an excellent taste for music, he was already a performer on several instruments. The king took care that he should receive a learned education, for he destined him to fill the See of Canterbury, and the illustrious Erasmus, noticing his aptitude for everything he undertook, did his best to cut and polish this English diamond, that it might glitter with the greater brilliancy. "He will begin nothing that he will not finish," said the scholar. And it is but too true that this prince always attained his end, even if it were necessary to tread on the bleeding bodies of those he had loved. flattered by the attentions of the young Henry, attracted by his winning grave, charmed by his wit, Erasmus on his return to the continent everywhere proclaimed that England at last had found its Octavius. As for Henry VII, he thought of everything but Virgil or Augustus. Avarice and ambition were his predominant tastes, which he gratified by the marriage of his eldest son in 1501. Burgundy, Artois, Provence, and Brittany having been recently united to France, the European powers felt the necessity of combining against that encroaching state. It was in consequence of this that Ferdinand of Aragon had given his daughter Joanna to Philip of Austria, and that Henry VII asked the hand of his daughter Catherine, then in her 16th year and the richest princess in Europe, for Arthur Prince of Wales, a youth about 10 months younger. The Catholic king made one condition to the marriage of his daughter. Warwick, the last of the Plantagenets and a pretender to the crown, was confined in the Tower. Ferdinand, to secure the certainty that Catherine would really ascend the English throne, required that the unhappy prince should be put to death. Nor did this alone satisfy the King of Spain. Henry VII, who was not a cruel man, might conceal Warwick, and say that he was no more. Ferdinand demanded that the Chancellor of Castile should be present at the execution. The blood of Warwick was shed, his head rolled duly on the scaffold. The Castilian Chancellor verified and registered the murder, and on the November 14th the marriage was solemnized at St. Paul's. At midnight the prince and princess were conducted with great pomp to the bridal chamber. These were ill-omened nuptials fated to set the kings and nations of Christendom in battle against each other, and to serve as a pretext for the external and political discussions of the English Reformation. The marriage of Catherine the Catholic was a marriage of blood. In the early part of 1502, Prince Arthur fell ill, and on the 2nd of April he died. The necessary time was taken to be sure that Catherine had no hope of becoming a mother, after which the friend of Erasmus, the youthful Henry, was declared heir to the crown, to the great joy of all the learned. This prince did not forsake his studies. He spoke and wrote in French, German, and Spanish with the facility of a native, and England hoped to behold one day the most learned of Christian kings upon the throne of Alfred the Great. A very different question, however, filled the mind of the covetous Henry VII. Must he restore to Spain the 200,000 ducats which formed Catherine's dowry? Shall this rich heiress be permitted to marry some rival of England? To prevent so great a misfortune, the king conceived the project of uniting Henry to Arthur's widow. The most serious objections were urged against it. "It is not only inconsistent with propriety," said Warham, the primate, "but the will of God himself is against it. It is declared in his law that if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing, Leviticus 20 verse 21, and in the Gospel John Baptist says to Herod, it is not lawful for thee to have thy brother's wife, Mark 6 verse 18. Fox, Bishop of Winchester, suggested that a dispensation might be procured from the Pope, and in December 1503, Julius II granted a bull declaring that for the sake of preserving union between the Catholic princes he authorized Catherine's marriage with the brother of her first husband, Accidenti Forsan Copula Carnali. These four words, it is said, were inserted in the bull at the express desire of the princess. All these details will be of importance in the course of our history. The two parties were betrothed, but not married in consideration of the youth of the Prince of Wales. The second marriage projected by Henry VII was ushered in with auspices still less promising than the first. The king, having fallen sick and lost his queen, looked upon these visitations as a divine judgment. The nation murmured, and demanded whether it was in the Pope's power to permit what God had forbidden. The young prince, being informed of his father's scruples and of the people's discontent, declared, just before attaining his majority, June 27, 1505, in the presence of the Bishop of Winchester and several royal counselors, that he protested against the engagement entered into during his minority, and that he would never make Catherine his wife. His father's death, which made him free, made him also recall this virtuous decision. In 1509, the hopes of the learned seemed about to be realized. On the 9th of May, a hearse decorated with regal pomp, bearing on a rich pall of cloth of gold the mortal remains of Henry VII, with his scepter and his crown, entered London, followed by a long procession. The great officers of state, assembled round the coffin, broke their staves and cast them into the vault, and the heralds cried with a loud voice, "God send the noble King Henry VIII long life!" Such a cry perhaps had never on any previous occasion been so joyfully repeated by the people. The young king gratified the wishes of the nation by ordering the arrest of Empson and Dudley, who were charged with extortion, and he conformed to the enlightened counsels of his grandmother by choosing the most able ministers and placing the Archbishop of Canterbury as Lord Chancellor at their head. Warham was a man of great capacity. The day was not too short for him to hear Mass, receive ambassadors, consult with the king in the royal closet, entertain as many as 200 guests at his table, take his seat on the woolsack, and find time for his private devotions. The joy of the learned surpassed that of the people. The old king wanted none of their praises or congratulations, for fear he should have to pay for them, but now they could give free course to their enthusiasm. Mantua pronounced the young king divine. The Venetian ambassador likened his port to Apollo's, and his noble chest to the torso of Mars. He was lauded both in Greek and Latin. He was hailed as the founder of a new era, and Henry seemed desirous of meriting these eulogiums. Far from permitting himself to be intoxicated by so much adulation, he said to Mantua, "Ah, how I should like to be a scholar!" "Sire," replied the courtier, "it is enough that you show your regard for those who possess the learning you desire for yourself. How can I do otherwise?" he replied with earnestness. "Without them we hardly exist." Mantua immediately communicated this to Erasmus. 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 The walls of Eltham, Oxford, and London resounded with the name. The king could not live without the learned, not the learned without Erasmus. This scholar, who was an enthusiast for the young king, was not long in answering to the call. When Richard Pace, one of the most accomplished men of that age, met the learned Dutchman at Ferrara, the latter took from his pocket a little box which he always carried with him. "You don't know," he said, "what a treasure you have in England. I will just show you." And he took from the box a letter of Henry's expressing in Latin of considerable purity the tenderest regard for his correspondent. Immediately after the coronation, Mantua wrote to Erasmus, "Our Henry Octavus, or rather Octavius, is on the throne. Come and behold the new star. The heavens smile, the earth leaps for joy, and all is flowing with milk, nectar, and honey. Avarice had fled away, liberality has descended, scattering on every side with gracious hand her bounteous largesses. Our king desires not gold or precious stones, but virtue, glory, and immortality." In such glowing terms was the young king described by a man who had seen him closely. Erasmus could resist no longer. He bade the Pope farewell, and hastened to London, where he met with a hearty welcome from Henry. Science and power embraced each other. England was about to have its Medici, and the friends of learning no longer doubted of the regeneration of Britain. Julius too, who had permitted Erasmus to exchange the white frock of the monks for the black dress of the seculars, allowed him to depart without much regret. This pontiff had little taste for letters, but was fond of war hunting and the pleasures of the table. The English sent him a dish to his taste in exchange for the scholar. Some time after Erasmus had left, as the Pope was one day reposing from the fatigues of the chase, he heard voices near him singing a strange song. He asked with surprise what it meant. "It is some Englishmen," was the answer, and three foreigners entered the room, each bearing a closely covered jar, which the youngest presented on his knees. This was Thomas Cromwell, who appears here for the first time on the historic scene. He was the son of a blacksmith of Putney, but he possessed a mind so penetrating, a judgment so sound, a heart so bold, ability so consummate, such easy elocution, such an accurate memory, such great activity, and so able a pen, that the most brilliant career was foreboded him. At the age of 20 he left England, being desirous to see the world, and began life as a clerk in the English factory at Antwerp. Shortly after this, two fellow countrymen from Boston came to him in their embarrassment. "What do you want?" he asked them. "Our townsmen have sent us to the Pope," they told him, "to get the renewal of the greater and lesser pardons, whose term is nearly run, and which are necessary for the repair of our harbor. But we do not know how to appear before him." Cromwell, prompt to undertake everything, and knowing the little Italian, replied, "I will go with you." Then slapping his forehead he muttered to himself, "What fish can I throw out as a bait to these greedy cormorants?" A friend informed him that the Pope was very fond of dainties. Cromwell immediately ordered some exquisite jelly to be prepared, after the English fashion, and set out for Italy with his provisions and his two companions. This was the man who appeared before Julius after his return from the chase. "Kings and princes alone eat of this preserve in England," said Cromwell to the Pope. One cardinal, who was a greedier cormorant than his master, eagerly tasted the delicacy. "Try it," he exclaimed, and the Pope, relishing this new confectionery, immediately signed the pardons, on condition, however, that the receipt for the jelly should be left with him. And thus were the jelly pardons obtained, says the annalist. It was Cromwell's first exploit, and the man who began his busy career by presenting jars of confectionery to the Pope was also the man destined to separate England from Rome. The court of the pontiff was not the only one in Europe devoted to gaiety. Hunting parties were as common in London as at Rome. The young king and his companions were at the time absorbed in balls, banquets, and the other festivities inseparable from a new reign. He recollected, however, that he must give a queen to his people. Catherine of Aragon was still in England, and the council recommended her for his wife. He admired her piety without caring to imitate it. He was pleased with her love for literature, and even felt some inclination towards her. His advisers represented to him that Catherine, daughter of the illustrious Isabella of Castile, was the image of her mother. Like her, she possessed that wisdom and greatness of mind which win the respect of nations, and that if she carried to any of his rivals her marriage portion and the Spanish alliance, the long-contested crown of England would soon fall from his head. "We have the Pope's dispensation. Will you be more scrupulous than he is?" The Archbishop of Canterbury opposed in vain. Henry gave way, and on the 11th of June, about 7 weeks after his father's death, the nuptials were privately celebrated. On the 23rd, the king and queen went in state through the city, the bride wearing a white satin dress with her hair hanging down her back nearly to her feet. On the next day, they were crowned at Westminster with great magnificence. Then followed a series of expensive entertainments. The treasures which the nobility had long concealed from fear of the old king were now brought out. The ladies glittered with gold and diamonds, and the king and queen, whom the people never grew tired of admiring, amused themselves like children with the splendor of their royal robes. Henry VIII was the forerunner of Louis XIV. Naturally inclined to pomp and pleasure, the idol of his people, a devoted admirer of female beauty, and the husband of almost as many wives as Louis had adulterous mistresses, he made the court of England what the son of and of Austria made the court of France, one constant scene of amusements. He thought he could never get to the end of the riches amassed by his prudent father. His youth, for he was only 18, the gaiety of his disposition, the grace he displayed in all bodily exercises, the tales of chivalry in which he delighted, and which even the clergy recommended to their high-born hearers, the flattery of his courtiers, all these combined to set his young imagination in a ferment. Wherever he appeared, all were filled with admiration of his handsome countenance and graceful figure, such as the portrait bequeathed to us by his greatest enemy. "His brow was made to wear the crown, and his majestic port the kingly mantle," adds Norrison. Henry resolved to realize without delay the chivalrous combats and fabulous splendors of the heroes of the Round Table, as if to prepare himself for those more real struggles which he would one day have to maintain against the papacy. At the sound of the trumpet, the youthful monarch would enter the lists, clad in costly armor, and wearing a plume that fell gracefully down to the saddle of his vigorous courser. "Like an untamed bull," says an historian, "which breaks away from its yoke and rushes into the arena." On one occasion, at the celebration of the Queen's churching, Catherine with her ladies was seated in a tent of purple and gold, in the midst of an artificial forest, strewn with rocks and variegated with flowers. On a sudden, a monk stepped forward, wearing a long brown robe, and kneeling before her, begged permission to run a course. It was granted, and rising up he threw aside his coarse frock, and appeared gorgeously armed for the tourney. He was Charles Brandon, afterwards Duke of Suffolk, one of the handsomest and strongest men in the kingdom, and the first after Henry in military exercises. He was followed by a number of others dressed in black velvet, with wide-brimmed hats on their heads, staffs in their hands, and scarfs across their shoulders ornamented with cockleshells, like pilgrims from St. James of Compostela. These also threw off their disguise, and stood forth in complete armor. At their head was Sir Thomas Boleyn, whose daughter was fated to surpass in beauty, greatness, and misfortune all the women of England. The tournament began. Henry, who has been compared to Amadis in boldness, to the lion-hearted Richard in courage, and to Edward III in courtesy, did not always escape danger in these chivalrous contests. One day the king had forgotten to lower his visor, and Brandon, his opponent, setting off at full gallop, the spectators noticed the oversight and cried out in alarm. But nothing could stop their horses. The two cavaliers met. Suffolk's lance was shivered against Henry, and the fragments struck him in the face. Everyone thought the king was dead, and some were running to arrest Brandon, when Henry, recovering from the blow which had fallen on his helmet, recommenced the combat, and ran 6 new courses amid the admiring cries of his subjects. This intrepid courage changed as he grew older into unsparing cruelty, and it was this young tiger, whose movements were then so graceful, that at no distant day tore with his bloody fangs the mother of his children.